From 94.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest this hour started his professional life in medicine. At one time, he was chief resident in psychiatry at Massachusetts General Hospital. While there, he published scientific papers, including one on his co-discovery of a form of bipolar disease that continues to be cited in psychiatric literature. But today, Charles Krauthammer is publishing on very different topics. A Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, his work appears in over 150 newspapers around the country, including the Charlotte Observer. Once a campaign speechwriter for then-Vice President Walter Mondale, his writing later helped develop the Reagan Doctrine in one of his many essays for Time magazine. He also contributes to The New Republic and The Weekly Standard, appears regularly on Fox News, but is heard almost as regularly on various NPR programs. Charles Krauthammer is in Charlotte under the auspices of the Learning Society of Queen's University for an event that we are told is sold out. So we are even more pleased that we have him for the hour prior to his visit this Thursday night. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C., and we thank him for being here. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
If you go to the Washington Post Writers Group website, they describe you as someone who offers clear and new perspectives on politics, foreign policy, and culture, often from the right. Often, but not always. And in fact, you, as I said, once served as a speechwriter for then-Democratic Vice President Walter Mondale and contributed articles to The New Republic. Still do, I believe.
Yes.
So today, where would you place yourself on the political spectrum, and how did you arrive at that place, or how do you arrive at various different places on the spectrum at the same time?
Well, I guess the short answer to that question is, I was young once. And, you know, we all have our youth and our flings. Now, I was brought up sort of as a capital D Democrat. And like many sort of middle-of-the-road Democrats, in the 1970s, I was a big fan of a Senator Henry Jackson, not well-known anymore. But he was from Washington State. He was a very tough Cold Warrior, very tough on the Ruskies in the Cold War. And his philosophy was, you know, very generous at home, great society, Lyndon Johnson, liberal, and on foreign policy, they're very tough. And I sort of saw him as my political ideal in those days. And I considered myself a Democrat in support of the party. But then I found that over time, two things happened. One is that the Democratic Party really lost its way in the Cold War, couldn't figure out that you had to be tough with the Soviets the way Reagan was. And secondly, on domestic policy, I'd always been kind of a big-hearted liberal. And then a book came out by Charles Murray called Losing Ground in the early 80s, which sort of demonstrated that all the good intentions of the Great Society by Lyndon Johnson had turned out to actually have hurt the poor. Things had gotten much worse despite, you know, giving all the money away, establishing all these anti-poverty programs. That liberalism, for all of its good intentions in trying to help the poor, was making things worse. And I know, you know, so that began me thinking about a more conservative approach to domestic policy. And then you have in the mid-90s, Bill Clinton, of all people, Democratic president with a Republican Congress, abolishing welfare, what that liberals said would be terrible, they'd be orphans in the streets and all that. And we know what the result of that has been. It's been an absolutely unbelievable success in lifting people out of poverty, getting them into jobs, and reducing all of the many of the pathologies of poverty. Well, so in some ways, that conservatism of domestic policy, I think, has been vindicated by history and by facts. So I feel pretty good about where I am politically right now.
Mm-hmm. But you still write for The New Republic.
In fact, I'm on the masthead of the New Republic, which is a kind of the New Republic, when I was there, I was an editor there for about 8 years in the 80s, and it was always known, particularly in the Reagan years, as a very eclectic magazine. We often had big arguments among ourselves in print. Some of us were against the nuclear freeze. I wrote against it. Others were in favor. So it was always a free, it wasn't a free for all, but it was a free venue where you could express yourself left and right. Mm-hmm. And I've stayed, you know, on the masthead as a result of that, even though to these days it's far more to the left than it was when I was there.
There are so many conservatives who were so angry about the Great Society and programs and welfare and things like that, that they ranted and raved and railed against it to the point where I think Bill Clinton didn't really have much of a choice, particularly given that the Congress was changing to Republican, but to abolish welfare. And it turned out that was the right thing to do, I think,
in many people's views,
because it seems to me that it was because, like anything else, there was a time and place for what happened under Lyndon Johnson, and then it just stayed, as opposed to being revised or phased out or changed in some way.
Right.
You never seem to be angry. You seem to be, when you write, you are incredibly thoughtful and almost, you feel like, you sometimes feel professorial in that you are teaching principles. You're trying to get your point across by teaching, taking great pains to explain yourself as opposed to just being angry. Is there more to be gained by doing it that way, you think?
Well, I always try to, I really do write in order to convince people. And if you just use epithets and a lot of adjectives, you're not going to get anywhere. I write the way I try to talk, which is the way I try to respect the person I'm talking to. I try to understand what their core beliefs are, and then I try to show them, if I can, that their core beliefs ought to take them to a place where I want them to go. So that's how I try to construct my arguments. Not to say I believe X, therefore you should believe it, but you believe X, and here's the logic that ought to lead you to Y, which is where I want you to be and where I think people ought to be. So it is in some ways perhaps professorial. I'd like to think it's perhaps more analytic. I try to break a question down to its basic core principles and see if I can appeal to my reader or interlocutor's own ideals and ideas in trying to make a case.
And we're talking with Charles Krauthammer, the syndicated columnist who appears quite frequently on NPR and, of course, on Fox News, and is writes for the Washington Post Writers Group and is syndicated in about 150 papers around the country, writes an essay monthly for Time magazine. I mentioned the Washington Post Writers Group, where they, I guess, post information about you so that they encourage you to be picked up by newspapers around the country. And on that website, you say, my beat is ideas, everything from the ethics of cloning to strategy in Afghanistan. I also do public service, like reading Stephen Hawking's books and assuring my readers that it's not you. They are entirely incomprehensible.
Yeah, I feel that.
I love that line.
I'm the food taster for a lot of my readers, you know. Stephen Hawking, as most of your listeners know, is a great physicist who wrote a book called A Short History of Time, which became a huge bestseller. So I sort of have an interest in physics and cosmology. So I went ahead and I read it. And then I said to myself, I don't understand a word, so I read it again. I actually did read it twice. And then I wrote a review saying, this book is completely incomprehensible. You know, you ought to have it on your shelf because people like having it in the house.
Uh-huh.
It's sort of like a totem. But don't open it because you're not going to get anywhere. I write about movies. I wrote about Hollywood the other day and a lot of stuff in the culture, which is sort of fun stuff. And then there's the serious stuff, which is wars and plagues and cloning and stem cells and bioethics challenges and all of that stuff.
You're all over the map in terms of what you write about, and that requires, it seems to me, a very well-read person, and it requires a very curious person. How do you choose what to write about, and then how do you stay up with all these different topics that you write about enough to be able to write the way you write about them?
Well, I've always been interested in a lot of things. I mean, that's sort of reflected in my crazy early career where I studied political theory first, then I went to medical school, and then I became a physician, became a psychiatrist, and I decided, no, that's not what I want to do, and then I started to write. So I've always had these interests in a lot of areas. I've always been interested in science. I really loved doing science when I was younger, so I've kept up with that, and I've always been terribly interested in politics. I studied that when I was younger as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always reading, and basically it's a lifetime accumulation of reading. Or as one of my friends says, you're living off a lot of intellectual capital, and you're not replenishing a lot of it. But, you know, if you just read every day about things you're interested in, by the time you get to my age, in my 50s, you've read a lot. So mm-hmm. you sort of have a pretty good idea of what the arguments are in a lot of different areas.
But you have an enormous amount of power because you have an enormous amount of influence. Do you ever second-guess yourself about topics that may be new to you that you're writing about, even though you have a very firm opinion and you've analyzed it, that, my gosh, I might be wrong?
Well, you know, I often do write that in... I wouldn't say often, but when I am in areas where I feel that I'm either new or somehow untrained, I will often say that I'm not that sure, or I'm ambivalent. I mean, I wrote a column about this new HBO series, Big Love, about polygamy and gay marriage. And I think the next last paragraph in my column last week, which is actually still out now, I said that on the issue of gay marriage, I'm ambivalent. I feel one way for some reasons, I feel the other way for other reasons, and I don't have a definitive view. Now, I will admit, I'm not often that way. I'm a bit of a hammer on a lot of stuff that I believe in, but there are issues that are so complicated and have so many variations and nuances that I think one has to have some respect for the subject matter. And say, you know, I'm not really sure.
As a conservative, so many conservatives are so certain about gay marriage that it's wrong, yeah. and that's the end of it. How can you be ambivalent and be a conservative about it?
Well, I mean, maybe then I'm not that conservative. I mean, I do believe it's a mistake. I think it's a mistake for society to essentially declare the complete equality of homosexual and heterosexual life. Not that I think one is morally superior. I'm not sure I'd make that judgment. But if you ask any parent, if you had the choice of your child growing up gay or straight, what would it be? And every parent would say, I'd prefer they grow up straight. And the reason is because life is a lot easier. You can have your own children. I mean, there are all kinds of levels of happiness and ease of life which come with being straight. I mean, apart from any of the moral judgments, I'm trying here to say, even if you don't have any moral judgments, it's obvious that people would like their children to grow up straight if that were doable. Now, some argue that homosexuality is completely genetic and ingrained, and that may be true for some. But clearly, from all the studies of Kinsey, Masters and Johnson's, Freud, and all of the autobiography that we read about, there's a spectrum between homosexuality and heterosexuality. And what society says has an influence over how people react. So from that perspective, I'd like society in its pronouncements, in its laws, and in what it teaches its children to have a preference for a straight lifestyle. On the other hand, I have enough gay friends who are attached to some loved one and who really feel the pain of not being able to have a public recognize union the way that I do with my wife.
I hate to do this, but I got to stop you because we have to take a break. We're coming right back with Charles Krauthammer.
Okay.
We're back at Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins, and our guest today by phone from Washington, D.C. is Charles Krauthammer, the syndicated columnist. I, unfortunately, because of our time constraints, had to interrupt him in the middle of concluding a very important thought here.
Well, I was getting kind of elaborate and wound up there, so I'll condense the ending, which is that on the other hand, I'm sympathetic to my friends who are gay, and I understand the pain they suffer. And as a result, I'm fairly neutral on this. I think society, probably if there were a referendum in my state on gay marriage, I would likely vote no, but it's not something I would crusade against.
But if you know the pain, and you know that many of your friends did not make a choice, they feel that it's organic.
Right.
Why would you deny them that?
Well, it's because of the long wound-up argument I made earlier, that I think overall it's better for society to maintain this distinction between gay and straight unions, if only for reasons of pedagogy.
What about extending tax breaks and visitation
rights? Oh, yeah, I think civil unions are fine. I mean, in that sense, sure, I'd want to see those conditions equalize. But marriage, you know, the word has a different resonance, it has a different history, has a different meaning, and I think it's a. I would, as you say, I wouldn't have any objection whatsoever to the civil union aspects, the sort of the nitty gritty life aspects. I probably, again, with great ambivalence, oppose the actual equality of declaration of equality in marriage.
We got into this discussion because you mentioned that you'd written a column about the new HBO show called Big Love, which is about polygamy in Utah among the Mormons, or a faction of the Mormons.
Yeah,
I have not seen that column. Did you say that if we say okay to gay marriage, then we have to say okay to polygamy as well?
I actually made that argument 10 years ago.
Okay,
almost. To the month in Time magazine, and Andrew Sullivan, who's a friend of mine and really eloquent writer and former editor of the New Republic, who's written in favor of gay marriage, he and I had a bit of a tussle back 10 years ago over this. And my argument was simple. Right now, marriage is defined as a union of two people of opposite gender. And if you believe in gay marriage, you say that that second requirement, the gender requirement, is arbitrary and unfair. But once you're saying that the second requirement, opposite gender, is arbitrary and unfair, it's hard to see how you can argue that the first requirement, that the number be exactly two and no greater than two, is not also arbitrary.
And others take it further, saying that it no longer has to be between two people. It could be between a man and a sheep.
Well, that's a little bit... I wouldn't take it that far. I think that's going a little bit over a cliff there.
Okay.
But I do think that the traditional requirements, for instance, I wouldn't tinker with the adult requirement. I wouldn't allow it with children. I think that is a requirement everybody would recognize as absolutely essential, responsible and consenting adults. But I do think that once you tinker with the gender requirement, I don't see why on principle you would be defending the number requirement.
Have you seen Big Love, the HBO
show? I did, and it was rather dull.
Dull and disturbing, I think. Anybody who would see it would run screaming from polygamy.
Well, I mean, a lot of psyches you have to please at once.
That's right.
Marriage one-on-one is tough enough, you know.
You have been called a neocon by some. Would you agree with that characterization, and how do you see that? Is that a pejorative term, or is it a term that has some, in your mind, positives to it?
Well, it is now being used pejoratively because people basically say the neocons got us into the Iraq War, therefore neocons are bad people or whatever, but it is being used as pejorative. It actually is an interesting term. It actually, I do think, defines a certain kind of political thinking, and I would consider myself neoconservative in that sense. But that's not how the word is being used in public discourse now. It really is basically saying, you know, warmonger-type conservative, as opposed to the more placid conservatives who've had their doubts about the Iraq War.
A lot of the neocons, as I understand it, were former, as you described yourself, Big D Democrats.
Yes.
And I read a paper that you wrote yesterday, and I cannot remember the name of it, but you really talk about the transition, I suppose, from where we came from with Franklin Roosevelt to where we are today. And it almost seems like a natural progression. And you're looking at FDR, you're looking at Truman, you're looking at John Kennedy.
Yeah.
And it almost seems like that's the next natural step. But a lot of liberals didn't want to embrace it because being a neoconservative talks about using American power for good in the world and for America's own good. And America's own good is good for the world. To paraphrase, I think, Woodrow Wilson, what's good for America is good for the world.
Well, I think that is true. I think liberalism was pretty tough in the use of American power to liberate people. Unapologetic. Franklin Roosevelt, of course, Second World War. Truman in the Korean War, and also the way he occupied Japan and Germany and helped to make them democratic. John Kennedy with the famous inaugural address about spreading liberty around the world. And what happened is the Vietnam War intervened after that. And liberals gave up on that vision, and they decided Vietnam either showed that we were reaching more than we could achieve, or that we were evil. Those were the two leftist ideas. We were either incompetent or we were just bringing evil to the world. We were imperialist, etc. You remember all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So what you got is liberalism broke with the tradition of FDR and Truman and Kennedy and adopted a kind of neo-isolationist foreign policy after Vietnam, or a combinationist foreign policy with the Soviet Union. You know, let's do arms control, let's leave them alone. And then it fell, ironically, to conservatives who traditionally had been the isolationists. It was in the, you know, before the Second World War, the isolationists were generally conservative. So then conservatives, under Ronald Reagan, took up the mantle that FDR and Truman and Kennedy had carried, which is to be assertive of American power and American goodness at the same time. He had the audacity to call the Soviet Union the evil empire, implying, obviously, that we were a city on a hill. We were the good guys. They were the bad guys. He said that. He didn't apologize for that. And then he used American power very powerfully to essentially defeat the Soviet Union and liberate half of Europe. Mm. So I think history actually vindicated, to a large extent, that vision, which has become associated with neoconservatism.
You have written extensively about American power and about how there's been nothing like this in the history of the world. You cannot even compare what we are today to the world today, to the Roman Empire, because we are ubiquitous. And also, unlike the Roman Empire, you write, we are not people looking to expand necessarily our territory. We are people that go into a situation reluctantly, and we go into it immediately demanding what is the exit strategy, which is something that you say the Romans certainly did not ask
right.
of themselves.
Yeah.
But a lot of people have trouble believing that because we are still in Japan. We are still in Germany, 60 years after World War II. We are still in Kuwait, even if there had not been a Gulf War II, an invasion of Iraq,
right.
we would still have a presence
sure.
in that part of the world.
Right.
So we go in and we don't leave. Now, we don't run the countries, but maybe we do, in a way.
Well, yes, I'm not sure that's really... I mean, it's true we are in Germany and Japan, but clearly Germany and Japan are independent countries. The main reason we're in Germany and Japan is that they want us to stay. Americans aren't very happy about having people in Germany and Japan. And, you know, in the late 60s and 70s, there was a big movement in the Senate, the Mansfield Amendment, to get the hell out of Europe and Japan, saying, you know, Second World War is over. This is a drain on our resources. Why are we spending all this money to maintain a garrison in Germany? And the reason was that the Soviets were on the other side of Germany and East Germany, and we did that as a way to protect our newfound allies. It was not because we had any desire whatsoever to run Germany or Japan. But Japan, there were enemies around. There was Korea, of course, North Korea and China, Communist China and the Soviets. And that was a base as a way to protect the new democracy in Japan, ultimately the new democracy in Korea, the new democracy in Taiwan. So we ended up kind of reluctantly keeping a garrison as a way to protect our enemies from totalitarians. So it was hardly a quest for empire. I mean, we're very different from the French and the British and the Dutch and the Spanish, who went into parts of the world, Asia, Africa, Latin America, took over, stayed, and ran the damn place for 100, 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what Americans want to do. Americans don't like to be abroad. Americans, we are this remarkable so-called empire. We go in somewhere, Afghanistan, the first question is, when do we get out? Well, that's not how the French imperialist and the British imperialist acted. They went in to colonize, stay, and reform. Now, in Afghanistan and in Iraq, we're very reluctant intruders, if you like. We want to help to set up a place that will be peaceful, reasonably representative, and decent, and get out, unfortunately, because of insurgencies in both Afghanistan and Iraq. That's not happened. And I think eventually we will leave the two countries if we can establish governments that can maintain themselves.
But there are a lot, I'm not sure that, I guess the rest of the world is somewhat scared of American power, depending upon what regime you're talking about.
Yeah, right.
But there seem to be a lot of Americans who are afraid of this as well, or suspicious of it, and you are a part of an organization called the Project for the New American Century.
No, I'm not.
You're not?
No, I've been on the internet, and every time I get interviewed, I get asked about this, and you know, the manifestos that they signed. I'm not a part of that at all.
Well, I'm glad. Okay, I'm glad you brought that up.
I know.
That,
that's where I got it. Brian Lamb interview. It comes up all the time.
Okay.
And so, I mean, there's this vast conspiracy of which the Project for American Century, which of course is completely insignificant, is supposed to be the heart of it. The fact is, if I were, I wouldn't apologize for it. But I'm not. I mean, it's just a fact. So.
Well, let's get back to neoconservatism, because there is, as you said, this negative aspect of it now, because people blame them for the incursion into Iraq. And are we wrong in thinking that neoconservatives thought that we should go into Iraq and topple Saddam Hussein because it would be better for the Middle East, and a democratized Middle East with Iraq as the fulcrum would lead to a better world, a safer world, less terrorism, more happiness in the Middle East, and therefore more happiness in America? Are we wrong to think that? Are we wrong to believe, as some do, that the toppling of Saddam Hussein was a foregone conclusion with the election of President George W. Bush, because people like Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz had written letters to President Clinton encouraging him to do that?
No, I think that's completely wrong.
Okay.
I know that is the general idea, that this was all hatched before and was ready to go when the Bush administration was elected. The fact is, if 9/11 had not happened, this would never have happened.
Okay.
And it wasn't just Paul Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld who wanted to remove Saddam. The U.S. Congress, by an overwhelming vote in 1998, passed the Iraq Liberation Act, which called exactly for the removal of Saddam Hussein. And it was signed by Bill Clinton. Everybody wanted him removed, but nobody wanted to go to war to do it. That was the national consensus. And I remember Paul Wolfowitz and, of all people, John Kerry were the only two people I can remember in the late 90s who had a kind of a plan for how you would remove Saddam. And that was to try to support some Shiite insurgents in the southern part of the country, in a liberated enclave of Iraq. And perhaps that kind of insurgency or revolution would spread. But there wasn't a single sane person that I know of, left, right, or center, who wanted to see the U.S. invade Iraq. It was not in the cards. It was never going to happen because we didn't want to have a war for that at that time for that reason. Although everybody agreed, as I mentioned in the Iraq Liberation Act, that he ought to be removed, so we were hoping sanctions would do it. And then 9/11 happened. And 9/11 was not planned. 9/11 was never part of any grand scheme. But 9/11 shattered all of our illusions about what was happening in the Middle East. For 60 years, we had assumed that we could support dictatorships, and we would be safe. It would give us oil, we would leave it alone, it would remain one of the few areas on the whole planet that had no democracy whatsoever. When 9/11, we realized that by abandoning the Arab world, allowing it to be run by dictators, creating intolerance, extremism, anti-Americanism and sort of extreme religious fanaticism. That was the incubation in all of these dictatorships. And that exploded on us in 9/11, that this was a losing proposition, that we had to change our direction. And that meant we had to stop supporting dictators, and we had to try to change the culture of the Middle East. And the invasion of Iraq was an attempt to do that.
Why there? Why not Saudi Arabia? Why not Syria? Why not Iran? Why Iraq?
That's a very good question. The answer is that, number one, Saddam was a real threat. He had invaded two countries. He tried to assassinate a president. He'd fired rockets at three of his neighbors. He'd used poison gas. He was a very bad actor. He had two sons who would succeed him. Sanctions were eroding. He had pursued weapons of mass destruction in the past. We were sure he had them. It turned out he didn't, but there wasn't a person I know of who thought that he did not. And so he was a very active threat. Secondly, there were UN legal resolutions. We had resolutions on Iraq which made it an international outlaw in a way that we could not demonstrate that kind of international illegality on the part of other countries. And lastly, we had been there. We had seen the Shia and the Kurds rise up against Saddam after the Gulf War. We had betrayed them by not supporting the revolutions that we had encouraged. Saddam had slaughtered them. And we kind of had a moral obligation, in a sense. If we were going to try to change the Middle East, we would go to a place where we'd had an opportunity a decade and a half ago and had betrayed those who had reached for it. So all of those conditions, I think, led to Iraq as the place you would go, which is where we went.
I have less than a minute left in this segment, but was it then, in your opinion, not a mistake to go into Iraq, but perhaps the mistake was made in terms of gauging the response of what would happen in the aftermath of going in?
I'm not one of those who believes that the Iraq war is a mistake. It's been terribly costly, a lot costlier than any of us have expected, and tragic in that sense. But if Iraq turns out to become a decent, self-governing, representative democracy, it will change the Middle East. And it will have been a very expensive success. So if I believed it was lost, the war was lost, I'd be talking about how we made an error at getting in. But I'm not one of those who believes the war is lost by any means.
Charles Krauthammer is our guest. He's a syndicated columnist, appears regularly in the Charlotte Observer. We will continue our conversation in a moment. We're back. I'm Mike Collins. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. Our guest today is syndicated columnist Charles Krauthammer, who will be in town Thursday evening at Queens College in an event that is sold out, so we are very happy to have him with us. And this is a pre-recorded conversation, so I'm sorry to say you can't join it by phone, but we'll try to ask many of the questions you may have asked had you had the opportunity to do so. You have let me get back to Iraq for just a couple of seconds. Not, I don't want to belabor this point, but if there have been mistakes made, you're saying that the mistake was not going in, but have there been mistakes made in the execution of going in? Could we have done it better?
Yes. In retrospect, there are things we should have done differently.
And why? Well, given the brilliance of, and there are brilliant people in any presidential administration, because otherwise, I mean, this country is not run by dumb people, it seems to me. Why have we made the blunders that we have made?
Because wars are unpredictable. And people make mistakes. You look at the American performance in the first year of our entry into the Second World War. It was one catastrophe after another. And then we understood the nature of the war. The enemy adapted our tactics and became extremely successful. But people don't remember North African campaign, our disasters in the South Pacific and all of that. Because all we remember is the victory at the end. So it's not, look, it's not an excuse. I'm just saying that in wars you make mistakes. Look at our Revolutionary War, which is a disaster for the first half of it. You make mistakes, you understand the enemy, and you adapt. Disbanding the Iraqi army was a mistake. Not shooting looters in the first week was a mistake. Now, at the time, these were honorable mistakes because the arguments on the other side were rather strong. Do you really want to have Americans shooting looters in the street of a country that we had liberated? That would have looked pretty awful. On the other hand, in retrospect, restoring order immediately, even at the cost of shooting looters, it would have been the right step. So there was a series of errors over time, which has made the war a lot more difficult. The withdrawal out of Fallujah was a mistake the first time. Second time, we went in and stayed. That was right. So, and I think our worst mistake was not when we had Muqtada al-Sadr, the radical Iranian-influenced sheikh who is now in the government, influencing the government. He took over on Najaf, and we had him defeated and beaten. We let him get away, and he's now an active and a malignant player in Iraqi politics. So a series of error over time, but, given their choices at the time, everybody's a genius after the war in making retroactive decisions. But at the time, they looked reasonable, but turned out to be wrong.
I may be wrong about this, so correct me if I am, please. But as I understand it, you have not been an advocate for democratic globalism or using the spread of democracy as the means and ends of foreign policy, but you have advocated democratic realism. If that's accurate, what's the difference?
Yes. Well, since we don't have an hour, when I gave that lecture, it was an hour lecture. The difference is that the globalists, the neoconservative globalists, of which I would include George Bush and Blair, Tony Blair, Great Britain, talk in very, very sweeping universal terms of bringing democracy to every corner of the earth. And I think we ought to have a more modest and contained foreign policy in which we target our efforts on democracy in the very specific areas where it's strategically critical. Afghanistan, Iraq is two examples. And go a little bit easier in places that are not quite ready and where destabilizing them would be a disaster. And I'm thinking here of Pakistan or Egypt or Saudi Arabia, which I'd want to see democratized over time, but I don't believe in trying to democratize everywhere all the time immediately, because I think that would be much too ambitious and in the end would be unsuccessful.
You have said that we live in a unipolar world, and this is true. I don't think anybody can refute this, in which the United States is the only superpower, and you believe as such that we should assert our positions and invite others to join us instead of waiting for international consensus.
Right.
This, I know we waited around for the UN for a while, but this is kind of what we did before we got into Iraq. We said, George Bush said, we were going in with or without United Nations approval. And in fact, that's exactly what we did. So in light of what has happened and how we are viewed in the rest of the world, in much of the rest of the world, do you still believe that?
Oh, I do. It happened in exactly the same way in the good war in the Gulf, the first Gulf War, the one that everybody remembers in a very rosy way. But I was here in Washington when all of that happened, and when Saddam invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, there wasn't a country on the planet that wanted to go to war and reverse that. The United States, under George Bush Sr., the father of the current president, stood up and said, we're going to reverse this militarily with you or without you. And he said that explicitly. We're going to do it alone or we'll do it with you. And, of course, a lot of other countries joined up. Now, 15 years later, a lot of other countries did not. Conditions have changed. But this idea of saying we're going in and either with us or without us, I think has to be our policy. Otherwise, we're never going to act in any way. We would not have had the first Gulf War. Iraq and Saddam would be in control of Kuwait, probably also in control of all of Saudi Arabia right now. So it was the right thing to do. The same in Afghanistan. We said after 9/11, we're going to do Afghanistan with others or without. Ended up only the British and the Australians were with us. Nobody else was with us on the ground. But we did it. And if we sat around and we waited for a consensus, we're never going to have a consensus. And that would mean a policy of complete isolationism and of passivity.
Charles Krauthammer, the syndicated columnist, is our guest this hour. You make, one of the things that has come out of the Bush administration, the current Bush administration, is this concept of preemptive strikes. This is a new way of thinking, I think, and a new way of acting for America, at least in the minds of many Americans and probably many people around the world.
Right.
You make a great case for preemptive strikes when you write, in the bipolar world of the Cold War, with a stable, non-suicidal adversary, the Soviet Union, deterrence could work. Deterrence does not work against people who ache for heaven. Has that thinking gotten lost in light of the discontent over what's happening in Iraq and over the fact that many people saw no connection between Saddam and those who attacked us on 9/11?
Well, that is so. I think the Saddam issue was an issue of changing the culture in the Middle East and removing an enemy of the United States. But I think this idea of the aching for heaven really applies today to Iran. I mean, you have a leader of Iran, the new president of Iran, who speaks openly about the coming of the Messianic Age, which is the Shia version of the Christian and the Jewish Messianic Age and the apocalypse. he sees it as happening in a few years, the return of the 12th Imam, as they speak of it. Here's a guy who wants to acquire nuclear weapons, who believes in the imminence of the apocalypse, and, you know, who runs the most terror-supporting regime on the planet, in which they have schools in which young people are trained to go do suicide attacks and go to heaven. So you're dealing with an enemy who may not be deterrable the way even Stalin was deterrable. So what do you do? And that's where you really have to think about preemption. That's why people are talking about, worrying about, thinking about, can we do a preemptive strike
on their nuclear facility? I hesitate to bring this up because of the way it may appear to some people, but there are a lot of conservative Christians who believe in the imminence of the apocalypse, and because the Christian right is associated with the Republican Party and the people in power now, there are some people who believe that there is an ache to precipitate this apocalypse.
I don't see a lot of Christian evangelicals who believe in the millennium itching to start a nuclear war so we can accelerate the advent of the second coming. I just don't see a lot of those folks, but I see a lot of those folks in Iran, and I see them in the leadership of Iran. In fact, the president yesterday, well, actually earlier this week, was asked in the press, in a speech he gave, I think, in Cleveland by a member of the audience, if he believed in the coming of the apocalypse. And he looked kind of stunned by that question, as if this is pretty weird. you know, he is not an apocalypticist, and the fact is the president of Iran is. Mm-hmm. So that's a big difference. I mean, you know, a lot of people believe in the second coming, sure, but the idea is, do you believe in starting a nuclear war as a way to accelerate that? The answer is no, but you've got people in Iran who may not look at it that way. And if they acquire nuclear weapons, it's going to be a very, very dangerous world.
There are people around the world who resent American power. There are people in this country who say, well, who are we to say this can be done or this cannot be done? And you have written that the landmine that protects civilization from barbarism is not parchment, not treaties, but power. And in a unipolar world, American power wielded, if necessary, unilaterally, if necessary, preemptively. So if that's true, that seems to me that it comes with a tremendous burden of making sure that we wield our power fairly and wisely. But who are we to judge the wisdom and fairness of our own actions? Aren't we too close to see the forest for the trees?
It's true, but it's the way everybody, individual, has to lead his life, and every country has to lead his life. All of us have to ask ourselves, are we acting in the right way? And in a democracy, we're guided by principles. Luckily, in this country, well-established principles. And I think if you look at our historical record, any objective observer would say that, say, ever since we became a great power 100 years ago, we have rescued and saved millions, hundreds of millions of people around the world from the worst kinds of tyrannies at great cost to ourselves and often selflessly. I mean, here's a country that went into Somalia. Have we got any strategic interest in Somalia? Zero. Just to help starving people. So there aren't a lot of countries who act as altruistically as America does, always helping relief efforts anywhere in the world, using our resources. We have made mistakes in the past, obviously, but I think if you look at the record, look at the countries where we ended up in control after the Second World War and where the Soviets ended up in control, east and west of Germany, Taiwan and China, north and south of Korea. Which of those split countries ended up benign, democratic, prosperous and free? All three countries who ended up on our side of the line. I think that tells you a lot about American beneficence and goodwill and altruism.
Charles Krauthammer, you once praised the Clinton administration for their approach to the Middle East by
saying... I'm sure, only once. And you found it.
I did.
Excellent research.
Anyway, you praised the Clinton administration for their approach to the Middle East by saying that one good thing they did was exercise restraint. Quote, there is a great temptation for Bigfoot to go in and to impose itself, but it has not. Why was that good foreign policy in the 90s, but not now?
because of 9/11.
Okay.
If 9/11 hadn't happened, I wouldn't want to see a Bigfoot. We wouldn't have had any invasions. We would not be in Afghanistan. We would not be in Iraq. 9/11 happened, and it told us that we had to use our power to change the conditions on the ground. Otherwise, you can hunt Osama from a cave, from one cave to another until the end of time, and that's not going to end the problem of terrorism, which can one day be a nuclear attack on the United States.
I'm glad that you brought up Osama, because a lot of people have bemoaned the fact that we've been in this conflict since September 11th, 2001, for what, 5 years now almost, and we have not yet captured or killed Osama bin Laden, something that they would see as being absolutely justifiable.
I would, of course, yeah, sure.
And you say that getting him would be nice, but this conflict is not about one.
Of course not. I mean, if you kill him and Zawahiri, there's going to be another guy, because the conditions that created him and Zawahiri in Saudi Arabia, Zawahiri in Egypt, and in the rest of the Middle East haven't changed.
But
unless they change, we're going to have a new Osama, a new Zawahiri,
but you say
and
that,
a new 9/11.
That this conflict is about the cauldron of political oppression, religious intolerance, and social ruin in the Arab-Islamic world. Oppression transmuted and deflected by regimes with no legitimacy into virulent, murderous anti-Americanism. I have 2 minutes left, but isn't our presence in Iraq increasing anti-Americanism?
As a short answer, I would say in the short run, perhaps, but you have to tolerate that increase in the short run if you're ever going to have a long run in which we change the Middle East and create a culture in which people live democratically and peacefully and not look for outlets of their oppression and intolerance by attacking the United States, as happened on 9/11.
Are we safer today, do you think, because of what we're doing over there?
Infinitely more safe. We haven't had an attack in 4.5 years, and I don't know a single individual in Washington or anywhere in the country who believed on September the 12th that we would go 6 months, 9 months, a year, even 2 years without the other shoe falling, and it hasn't. And that's because we've taken the fight to the enemy.
But some would say that we have created a summer camp for terrorists over there in Iraq. Have we not done that?
Well, there's a summer camp where they're under attack all the time. These guys weren't sitting around and all of a sudden decided to become jihadists after the Iraq war. These are people who are sitting around plotting attacks on the U.S. or our allies all over the world and have now ended up in Iraq, or at least we have a chance to shoot them, defeat them, isolate them, and win the war. So I think if that's the circumstance, this is a superior one to having them hiding in cells all over the world waiting to attack us clandestinely.
Charles Krauthammer, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure.
I'm Mike Collins.